Well, good afternoon. So as Roger Mark mentioned, I'm now based in Nepal. I've been there for a bit over 3 years. We've been working on this this big USAID-funded program, and we're starting to get some really interesting results. I'm going to talk about, we're working on various things, but I'm really going to focus on the climate adaptation part of it here, and particularly the community adaptation. There are three main components to the project, so biodiversity conservation, sustainable landscapes, payments for ecosystem services, particularly REDD+, and climate adaptation. And then we have three cross-cutting programs as well, so gender and social inclusion, which is particularly important in Nepal, livelihood improvement, which is very important for maintaining Nepal's forests, and governance, also very important. Roger Marks already mentioned the consortium. We came together as two environmental organizations and two development organizations, but we also work very closely with the government of Nepal, with local community groups, NGOs, civil society. We have a $30 million program running until 2016. And we work in two large landscapes. You can see it's a very complicated project. Three main themes, three cross-cutting themes, four partners, two landscapes. The landscapes are the Chitwan Annapurna landscape, which is the whole of the Gandaki River Basin in Nepal, and then the Terai Arc landscape, which has been going for over 10 years now in Nepal. But the Gandaki River Basin is a new landscape for Nepal. So we're doing large-scale conservation and development and climate change. So the main impact that Nepal is seeing from climate change are unpredictable monsoons. So a monsoon doesn't start on time, it stops, it starts again, it goes on too late, it spoils the rice, so on and so forth. So big challenges for agriculture, for livestock, for people. And sometimes it rains too much at the wrong time. So more intense rain, greater intensity of storms. Snowstorms and rainstorms, so floods, particularly down in the low-lying Terai. But higher up, that intense rainfall is also causing a lot of soil erosion and landslides in many parts of the country. And then when all the sediment that gets washed into the rivers from the erosion and the landslides, it goes down the steep slopes of the Himalayas. We're working from about 26,000 feet, all the way down to almost sea level. And when that water rushes down and then it suddenly flattens out into the plains of the Terai, those sediments get dumped. And so we see a lot of deposition in rivers, on people's fields, lots of rivers abraded, changing course, and then also water flowing underground during the dry season, because there's all that porous sediment stuff that it goes down on. So big changes in the hydrology. People's water supplies consequently being changed, at the top from glaciers retreating, in the mid-hills through changes in water table, and then lower down through changes in rivers. We're also seeing changes in animal diseases, agricultural pests, seeing species moving uphill. And sometimes it's good. Apples grow in Mustang now, and they never used to. But at the same time, mosquitoes moving uphill, diseases moving uphill. Not always getting that cold frost to kill diseases off in the wintertime. And climate change is also often exacerbated by other non-climate stresses on the environment. Overgrazing, which is quite as bad a problem as it used to be because people are rapidly destocking, but in some places there is still a lot of livestock. Collection of firewood is a huge one. It's causing a lot of deforestation. And when deforestation happens, landslides are more likely to happen, soil erosion and so on. Water runs off faster. And then a very new emerging threat is infrastructure development. And since the end of the civil conflict, Nepal has been rapidly expanding its infrastructure, which it needs to in order to develop. But it's happening in a way that's causing a lot of environmental degradations and social problems. So a lot of roads that are unplanned, undesigned, and not properly engineered. Dams that are causing big hydrological changes and affecting freshwater biodiversity, and so on and so forth. And all of this is combining with climate change to exacerbate the situation. So I want to talk just a little bit about our approach to local level climate adaptation. We're working on adaptation at very many levels, from landscape level all the way down to village level and site level. But I'm going to focus mostly today on the local level work. And so our approach here, we're using tools that CARE had developed. We've taken them, we've adapted them, we've integrated ecosystem aspects into them. So we start off working, when we go into a community, working to identify who are the really poor people who maybe don't have a voice, who can't automatically sit at the table with the community to do a vulnerability assessment. So that plaque at the top there, that stands for Community Learning and Action Center. And we work with the poorest, most marginalized people and with women in communities, working on their local issues, building their self-confidence, enabling them to just come to the table, to speak out in meetings, giving them self-esteem, self-confidence to do that. We also build general awareness about climate change so that people can participate. And then we may do some entry-level, community-level activities as well. So here's a typical CLAC, Community Learning and Action Center. Most of the participants tend to be women, and they tend to be lower caste people. But we also get some men participating. And it's amazing, after 16 weeks in these learning centers, people are so empowered. They're just so enthusiastic. They're solving some of their life problems. Sometimes it's things like getting citizenship, and they don't know how to do it. And, you know, you need citizenship for many things in Nepal, but without it, they've been excluded. But we bring it around to forests and natural resources, and very often these are the poorest people who are most dependent on natural resources, often applying a lot of pressure because they don't have alternatives. After we've done that, we start doing vulnerability assessments. And we look at the community's vulnerability, but we also look at the vulnerability of their ecosystems, because we believe that you actually can't separate these things. We don't talk about CBA and EBA, so community-based adaptation, ecosystem-based adaptation. We do the whole thing together because we believe that ecosystems can help people to adapt, but at the same time, people have to help ecosystems to adapt in order to continue to provide environmental services. And so then we move on to a visioning, and then the community will work out what their options are for overcoming many of the problems that are arising from climate change. So we do focus group discussions. We have a manual now, which we adapted from CARE's tools, and we've developed particularly for Nepal that it can be used in other places. And people do things like they assess the different ways that they're vulnerable, and they rank those, and then they do a map to say, you know, which particular ecosystems are vulnerable, where are landslides most likely to happen, where is it most likely to flood, where are crops failing, where are houses vulnerable, where are pastures failing, that kind of thing. And then they go on and they formulate plans for what they can do about it. And then finally, we come on to developing a monitoring system for their adaptation plan, and then we move into implementation. And really, what's been amazing to me in managing this project is the wide range of things that we do. You know, we do agriculture, we do disasters, we do conservation, forests, wildlife, we do health, we do education. It really just depends how people are vulnerable. And what's been really, really great about these funds, the climate funds that we have from USAID's Nepal mission for this, is that we can use them for anything to reduce vulnerability. I hardly ever had funds which have been so totally flexible. So it's been quite a revelation to me. So we do in forest activities, we try and improve livelihoods there if we can, if there are resources and there's a market for it. So that this bottom left photograph is making nettle powder, which is a medicinal in Nepal. But very often there may not be potential in people's forests, and so we may help them to improve their agriculture by capturing rainwater so that they can continue to grow even if the rains stop, or they can cultivate out of season. Maybe we use plastic tunneling if it's in a cold area so that they can grow in colder weather. But quite often it's work actually off-farm. There's a huge out-migration at the moment in Nepal. People going to the Middle East, going to Japan, Indonesia, India, all sorts of places, because there just aren't the employment opportunities at home. And so by working to give them skills, it helps them to stay. Or if they are going to migrate, it helps them get a better job when they go. But we also work on building ecosystem resilience. So in the top right-hand picture, for example, people are restoring a pond that was closing over because the water coming into it was less. So they're digging it out, and they're also removing invasive species. The middle picture there, we think that fire is going to increase a lot with climate change because relative humidity is going to go down as temperatures increase. And so we do a lot of work with communities on how to control fires safely. We do a lot of tree planting to restore ecosystems, to restore water supplies, local micro-catchments, to reduce the risk of landslides and so on. And then communities go out to patrol their forests to safeguard their natural resources. And then we also reduce human-wildlife conflict. We think that as climate change advances, there are going to be times when wildlife is going to be pushed for resources, and there's going to be more conflict over crops and over livestock. And so we electric fence is the best way to do this at the moment. So we've been doing quite a lot of fencing. So coming now to health, this is a list of the likely or actual climate impacts on health in Nepal. Waterborne diseases are already a big issue, but they're likely to become worse as flooding becomes more intense, more extreme, more frequent. But also respiratory diseases. Nepal is getting more cold snaps, particularly in the Terai, and very often there can be days and days when the fog just doesn't lift, the sun doesn't get through, it's very, very cold. So a big increase in pneumonia and other respiratory diseases, flu epidemics. At the same time, temperatures overall on average are rising, and so insects are moving up, so mosquito-borne diseases are increasing. Human wildlife disease transfer, we're concerned that as wildlife is pushed out of areas in extreme circumstances and drought and flood, there's going to be more contact with people and with livestock, and so greater transmission. And that transmission goes both ways, it goes all three ways. You know, wildlife, for example, populations of tiger, black buck, swamp deer, which are very rare in Nepal, can be exposed to new diseases. But then wildlife can also transmit diseases to livestock and people. So what we're doing in terms of health, where health vulnerabilities are identified, we're working very much through existing partners of CARE and WWF, working with female community health volunteers, who we worked with in the PHE work in Nepal. So it's great to be able to work with them, add one more thing to their portfolio, explaining to them about climate change, what it is, what the likely impacts are in their area, and what they can do to help, particularly on the health side, but also on the forest side. So the kinds of interventions that we're doing, water and sanitation is an obvious one. And not only water and sanitation, but helping people to conserve their catchments so that their water sources will be protected for as long as possible. Improving nutrition. And biogas is a really great one for that, because the slurry that comes from biogas can be used in vegetable gardens, so we can improve nutrition that way. It also spares the forest, because people aren't collecting firewood anymore. It saves women work and time for other household work, for work in the community, for forest management. All sorts of benefits. Livestock are kept near the household for the dung to fuel the biogas digester, and so there's milk for children to drink, and extra milk can be sold. So all sorts of benefits from biogas that help to reduce people's vulnerability to climate change. Some of this may sound like, yeah, this is business as usual. And it may be often we do the same activities that we used to do, but we're doing them for a different reason. We're doing them because we've identified that people are vulnerable to climate because of certain issues, and we're using these mechanisms to overcome these vulnerabilities. And then we're also doing things like mosquito nets. And one of the things that's come out of the Community Learning and Action Centres, which is really great, is that because we empower people to speak up for their rights, they're actually able to advocate to get better healthcare. And so we've had a few cases of communities that have actually been able to convince government to open new health posts nearer to them. People who have 4 or 8 hour walks to get to health services are able to get government to provide them closer. We've also been working on disasters. The recent floods in the Terai in August last year, an example. So we're helping people to build back better and take climate change into account. So don't just go and build. If you got flooded out last year, think about zoning and don't just build in the same places, but think about, you know, how people can maybe build slightly higher up. And also thinking that floods are probably going to get more extreme still as climate change advances. So thinking about zoning. We're also doing a lot of bioengineering to help to reduce flooding and landscapes. And one thing that we've realized with community adaptation is we can't just do it at local level. It doesn't work. You know, you can help people to protect themselves all you want, but if there's bad land use up in the catchment, you can't stop those landslides. You can't stop their fields getting dumped with rubble. And so we're promoting upstream, downstream collaboration between communities and bringing in, forest department and others who can help. We're also mainstreaming adaptation into local planning. We realize just having an adaptation plan as a standalone doesn't work. You have to get it mainstreamed into local sectoral plans, and you also have to leverage funding for it. We provide seed funding, but we can't pay for everything. And so we've been getting some good experience with that. We're monitoring long-term effects of climate change. We've got a really nice series of plots altitudinally going from a few hundred meters above sea level right up to the Tibet border. And we'll be monitoring that in the long term, way after Hari Uban finishes, to see what the changes are to biodiversity and people. So some of our lessons. Working right down at community level has been really great for really, really getting at local issues and making sure that we tackle the problems that people have, because they can vary from village to village very much. And then integrating the ecosystem and community parts brings a lot of benefits and helps to avoid maladaptation. I mentioned the multisectoral nature, which is really, really important, and the importance of flexible funding. We have to work at multiple scales to take into account the ecosystem side. It's tough. The institutions aren't always right. Institutions are based on village development committees, districts, regions. Ecosystems are based on water catchments and, you know, river basins and so on. So the institutional arrangements are a challenge for this, and we're learning lessons as we go on this. And then the other thing is you don't always know how an ecosystem is vulnerable until it's a bit later on. We are doing modeling to look at, you know, which are the likely refugia, which areas are on north-facing slopes and steep valleys, which aren't getting hot so quickly, and then taking that into account in our planning as well. But we're learning so much as we go. Hopefully by the end of 5 years, you know, we'll be able to really, really document all this. But even as much as we've done, we're now working with other ministries to integrate these concepts and trying to mainstream them so that this will be sustainable after we finish. Thank you.